Hey listeners, if you love The Santhro Life and you want to support the show, Anchor.fm makes it super easy to do. They give you options to donate $1, $5, or $10 on a monthly basis. Whatever you choose to support us with, we're grateful to have you, and it's going to help us produce better and better content.
And now, on to the show.
Hey everybody, welcome to the fourth episode of the This Anthro Life Savage Minds crossover series. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Ryan Collins. And today, we were happy to have Christina Kilgrove of the University of West Florida join us today. Dr. Kilgrove is an assistant professor at the university, and she's also extremely prolific. She has an award-winning blog powered by Osteons. Please check it out. It's really incredible. And she's also part of a collaborating writer with Forbes as well as for Mental Floss, and she's with the SAA's, the Society for American Archaeology's Media Committee. So she is constantly working for public-facing efforts in anthropology.
Yeah, and we had a really wonderful conversation we can't wait to dive into. We looked into some of the most fun facts about bones, tell us stories about ourselves. You may know that, but of course, you know, we don't always look at them because they're inside our bodies, and then when you see them, they usually tend to be in the ground. But bioarchaeology is her specialty and what Dr. Kilgrove works in, and so we really dove into how bones tell stories, and that really got us into this great conversation about what it means to tell stories and how do we tell stories for different kinds of audiences. And so, the themes that we've been seeing explore the whole time have continued to develop and grow, and so we're really excited to bring you this episode. And without further ado, hope you sit back, relax, and enjoy with Dr. Christina Kilgrove. Dr. Christina Kilgrove, thank you so much for joining us. You are a multi-talented, multi-acting anthropologist, bioarchaeologist, blogger, writer, activist. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about how you would characterize your own work, since you work between so many institutions as a professor, as on the board with the Society for American Archaeology, writing for Forbes, writing for Mental Floss, your own blog powered by Osteons. How do you characterize your work?
Well, I characterize my work as very interdisciplinary, for one thing. As a researcher, I meld science and history and theory because I am an anthropologist who also works in the classical world. And if you know anything about the history of classical archaeology and anthropology in the U.S., in academia, it's been a very fraught relationship where they're in two different departments and there's not often a whole lot of overlap. So as a researcher, I have had to figure out how to go between these fields, not just in terms of taking classes in the different fields, which is easy enough, but in terms of getting grant funding for my own research. And in order to do that, in order to apply to the National Science Foundation or the National Endowment for the Humanities, I had to be able to translate my interdisciplinary work to sort of a general educated audience. And that has really informed my outreach as well. Having to learn to speak and to write these sort of languages, you know, the jargon of these two different fields, to convince anthropologists that classical archaeology is an good discipline, to convince classicists that anthropological approaches to the past are useful. This has really informed how I write, not just how I write articles and grant proposals, but how I write for the general educated public as well.
So when you're thinking about stories that you want to write, for the general public or for your work in general, what type of stories do you look for that you find intriguing?
That's a good question. I tend to, first and foremost, look for a story that's relatable, right? It's important to pitch a story and to write a story to convince people to care about it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to click on your post. They're not going to read your article if they don't think that they're going to care, if it's not relatable to their daily lives. So I tend to focus on stories that I can either sort of personalize the past or relate it to a contemporary issue, something in the news or, you know, just something generally ongoing. So I want it to be relatable to a general audience. I generally want the story to be a little bit provocative, not necessarily in sort of, you know, provoking an awful response, although that sometimes happens, but encouraging people to read more into the subject, into bioarchaeology or into anthropology. And also, it's important to be able to tell stories. These are sort of short form stories in 800 words, really, is about how long my posts are. And so that post or that article needs to be holistic. It needs to be all there. A person reading it needs to get the entire sense in 800 words, which is a lot more difficult than it sounds. And so those three things really inform sort of how I choose stories to cover.
So since we're looking at archaeology, we tend to be materially focused, right? I'm speaking as an archaeologist myself, but not working in the classical world, working in Yucatan, Mexico, and not even with the classic Maya. So I'm really just not into classics that much. No offense. But I am definitely into classics in terms of everything else. It's just a bad joke. So
he's not a very classy guy, is what he's trying to say.
Exactly. But we tend to focus on materials. So do you use a sort of emphasis on cool material findings to bring a relatable perspective forward in a way that maybe a sociocultural anthropologist might not?
Sure. I mean, in a sense, I generally write about the skeletons and for the most part, those skeletons don't have grave goods. There's sort of been a focus more recently in bioarchaeology on, you know, those people who aren't in the history books, not the sort of most famous people, the ones with the most grave goods. And so it's really telling a story about them from their bodies, which obviously are, you know, material in the way that they're buried. That can also be important. But I don't write a whole lot about artifacts. That's sort of not my thing. I'm people, not pots. I was never that into pottery. I took pottery analysis classes, and it was just not my thing.
I can identify.
But you know, the human body is interesting. You can learn a whole lot from them. It's, you know, I always say it's a time capsule. You don't just get information about the point of death, but you can get information back 5 years or, you know, 20 years to, you know, their birth from their teeth. And so I think it's not really a niche topic, but it's a subfield of archaeology that honestly not a lot of people in the general public know about. They know that skeletons are cool, but they don't know what skeletons can tell you about the past. So that's what I try to do.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I ask is because I saw a repost that you had on Powered by Osteons on Facebook, and it was showing a prosthetic toe on an individual from far in the past. And I didn't get to look too much into the story, but just that image of a prosthetic toe is very evocative in a sense that you're getting not just at that person's death, but something that they dealt with in life. You're getting a part of their daily life, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes me think, I mean, because, you know, part of what I hear you saying is, which I think I really appreciate, is that this is, on one level, about getting people's stories out there and telling stories in provocative ways. And something that I think strikes us as anthropology is particularly adept at doing, right? I mean, as the study of humanity itself, it finds ways to sort of dig into the past as well as into the present and what, you know, conjecture about the future. And so I love the idea of working with bones and this kind of stories they have. You know, obviously this the word bones itself springs up the idea of the TV show Bones itself, right? And the forensic anthropologist, right? And that was one of the good times that, you know, anthropology got to be on TV. And hopefully we'll continue to do so. But this idea, I think, so in terms of the way that stories get told, I am really intrigued by the notion of thinking really on a super practical level that when you have to look for funding, when you're trying to get money to be able to do something, it does matter how you tell the story. And maybe we can think through some of the tactics or a little bit about your process of how you thought through, and you don't have to read a grant or anything for it, but, you know, how you, your process of thinking through what it means to tell a story, how to tell a story in a way that captivates whether a grant reading audience or, you know, and then to move that on to something like Mental Floss or Powered by Osteons.
Sure. Honestly, this is the hardest question because I don't know. I don't really know how to talk about how I write. That's really the hard thing. I just sort of write. But I mean, it's always important to develop a message, right? Whether it's a grant proposal, you know, or a short form article on a blog, to hone that message. and to stay on message, because so many, you know, grant proposals and other sorts of things just veer off topic, and then you're less likely to get funded, and student papers tend to do this too. So, you know, developing that message is important. And one of the things that I tend to do, and I tell people this, and it's maybe crazy advice, but I think about those movie trailers, you know, the sort of classic movie trailer where you say, in a world where, you know, like something happens. Think about that. Like I do that as sort of a mental exercise. I never write that on a grant proposal, you know, sending it to Wenner-Gren in a world where the Romans, no. But if you sort of think in that mentality, it helps you think about, you know, the words or the terms or the theories that you're going to draw out. And so, you know, I even tend to write this down sometimes, my in a world where sentence, so that I can go back to it as I'm writing the grant proposal and stay on message. So I think that's really important. Whatever you're doing is to stay on message.
And does this filter over into as well, the classroom? Cause obviously that's a very different audience where the students can't leave for an hour and a half, or 50 minutes or whatever it would be, you know? And so do you sort of apply this same storytelling tactic across writing? I mean, I know lecturing might be a little different, but in terms of even maybe how you write a lecture, is this format kind of work across processes, or is it?
Wow, I wish I could say that my lectures were that interesting. They're really not. I'm good at short form, like 800 words. If I could lecture in 800 words, that would be fine. I do tend to write lectures that are more conversational, that, you know, open up the floor for discussion. And I try to stay on message, but it is definitely not the in a world where type of thing, the movie trailer approach to lecturing.
So again, like thinking about the story and the crafting behind writing, whether this is, even if it's podcasting like we're doing right now and we're talking, how do you envision, say, talking to people in a classroom versus outside of a classroom with how you may work with Powered by Osteons, for example, or with writing with Forbes? Do those audiences, do they mean something different?
I don't think that they're really different audiences, honestly. In terms of sort of the level of writing that I do at Powered by Osteons or Forbes, the language that I use, that's pretty much the language that I use in my introductory classes, right? I'm not going to use all of the jargon that I would use with a graduate class or even an upper division class that is, you know, studied human osteology. I will use the word kneecap instead of patella, you know, until they've learned that. I tend to write for the sort of, you know, educated public, but, you know, somebody who has an interest in the topic but doesn't know a lot about it. So somebody who is, you know, an introduction to anthropology student or somebody who is a member of the general public with an interest in anthropology. I think those audiences are, obviously, they're coming to me in a different way, but the way that I'm sort of talking to them and the words that I'm using and the way that I approach it is really the same.
What was there in terms of, we're totally jumping back and forth here in these ideas, which I love. It's like, so part of this is this classroom. The other side is writing for, you know, different sized blogs and publication houses like Mental Floss as well as Forbes. What was your impetus to write for those? Was it a similar idea of wanting to tell a story, or that these would have a nice impact for anthropology? They just seem fun. Did they find you? Did you find them, or what was kind of the process there?
Money.
Yeah.
No. they both cold hard cash. They both found me actually. And both, you know, Mental Floss and Forbes offered me money. So, you know, that's money for something I was doing already at Powered by Osteons. I'm not going to turn that down. At Forbes, my editor at Forbes remembered me because in 2011, I had actually done a crowdfunding attempt to raise money for my latest research project. I had already graduated with my PhD. Mm-hmm. I was adjuncting. I didn't really have access to the sort of grants that I could get with a permanent position. So I did some crowdfunding with some other scientists. And it was covered by a CNN blog, and then it was covered by my now editor at Forbes. And I raised $12,000, which was awesome. I love the general public. so, you know, that sort of helped me learn to talk to the general public and make a tiny video and everything. And then years later, like 4 years later, my editor at Forbes had remembered me and sort of looked me up and offered me a slot at Forbes with a regular column. And then so from that, my Mental Floss editor got in touch with me because she liked my work and wanted to know if I wanted to contribute there. So it was just sort of an embarrassment of riches over the last couple of years. Not in the sort of literal sense, but yeah.
Yes, and the treasure trove of the heart, right? And the brain. No, that's fascinating. I mean, so one of the things that makes me think of too is then, I mean, do we feel, because Ryan and I talk about this a lot of times too, in terms of like where on one level is social science, anthropological research going? And so we do see a lot more of these kind of crowdfunding projects, whether through websites like Instrumental or Beacon, which is now defunct, which is doing journalism, or whether Kickstarter or Patreon and other things. And so it seems like on one level, the general public, A, is awesome. And then B, on top of that, like there is this move for a lot of researchers and a lot of people to be writing. And what we might actually just call it more directly for impact. I liked actually, so last week's episode with Daniel Salas from Sapiens, one of the points he brought up a quote from Sarah Kensington, an anthropologist, that says that anthropology is journalism that takes too long. You know, and kind of gave this a different way. And so another piece of this actually is, it seems to me, like going towards crowdfunding itself as a way to fund research, but also to be in direct contact with people that would be directly impacted by the work, and also to generate excitement for it. So it seems to me, I mean, and maybe in your view too, like is there a shifting landscape that we're seeing with social science, anthropological, classical research, archaeological research, that we are seeing the rise of this? And I mean, do you see that as a good or a bad thing, or you know, how does it attack you?
Right. That's a big loaded question.
Right. Yeah. You got paid. How do you like it?
Yes. Yeah. And my answer is yes. No. So yeah, it is definitely a sort of shifting landscape, especially with Web 2.0 and the rise of, you know, being able to blog and crowdfund and do all of these cool things. It's important for us to talk to the general public to get around things like paywalls, right? The general public is not going to read our articles at Elsevier that, you know, are behind paywalls. So if we don't want journalists to talk about it and potentially misconstrue it, it's important for us as researchers to talk about that. And that means we need to be flexible. We need flexible speaking styles and flexible writing outlets. And one of the things that has, you know, been happening in this new century is that we have this abundance of writing outlets. We don't have to rely solely on journalists to find our work and write it up in the local paper or the national paper. We can write op-eds. We can start blogs. We can go on podcasts. We can start after-school clubs in anthropology at our kids' schools. We can go and, you know, talk to foreign language venues as well. And so, I mean, I think this is important. In anthropology, this is actually not something new. Margaret Mead, for example, had a column in Red Book magazine for years. Ashley Montague was on The Tonight Show. Froilich Rainey had his TV show, What in the World? And so I think we're seeing this sort of resurgence of this kind of public anthropology, but in a very different way, you know, where now we have Web 2.0 and blogs and other sorts of things. We're just sort of seeing that landscape revitalized and shifted.
Okay, before we get into more conversation with Dr. Cassandra Kilgrove, we just wanted to bring up that we are 4/5 of the way through our collaboration with Savage Minds at this point. So please go back and listen through the other episodes if you get a chance. I think you'll see that the themes we have for each episode are really building upon each other and showcasing a real diversity on what it means to engage with a public audience, to foster public education, and to really put out what sort of matters for the future in anthropology, especially in the age of digital media and productions with blogs and podcasts like we're doing today.
And speaking of websites, if you have the time, we'd love you to check out our new user listener survey. We have this sitting at the top of our menu on our website. And what we're doing with this is we're trying to understand who you are, our audience, to find a better way to bring you content that you're looking for, understand the demographics, information like that. So we, you know, all the information we're going to collect will be totally anonymous and private. But if you want, you can click on that link on the top of our website and then drop us your email, and then we'll email you, and we're looking to just basically do a short 10-minute Skype interview with either Ryan, myself, or our colleague Matt Arndt, who's helping us with a lot of the work behind behind the scenes on the website. And we're just excited to get to know you a little bit more. We've been talking to a lot of folks on Twitter, and it's been really encouraging to us, as well as through the feedback mechanism we have on our website, which is this where you drop us your email. It's been really cool to see, and we're excited. We're actually going to be bringing you some fan mail episodes soon because we have enough now, which is awesome. And so we're super excited about that. One other piece of housekeeping we love to drop with you guys and see if you know is that we do have a PayPal donation thing. TAL is totally self-funded. We make this out of the kindness of our hearts and the emptiness of our wallets, I suppose. And we would love it if you'd be willing to underwrite us and toss us a couple of bucks to help keep the lights on. We recently are so excited to announce that we actually surpassed 50,000 downloads just the other day. And so we are ecstatic about that, and more people are accessing the show. We have more than doubled our downloads this month working with Savage Minds, which has been incredible. We're so grateful to them for helping co-produce this episode with us. But all that means that we are end up actually paying more for web services. We will keep doing it because we love making TAL for you and for ourselves. And so if any of you are able to, we would be more than grateful if you would be willing to underwrite us just a little bit, or a lot. It's up to you. But you can give securely through PayPal on the link that says underwrite TAL on our page. Without further ado, we'll get you back to the conversation. Thanks for checking us out.
One of the things that I'm really seeing with our conversation today that kind of contrasts a little bit with some of the conversations we've had are working past this idea that having a public-facing outlet for discussions is something that we have to constantly work for, because it sounds like with you, you've been just doing this from the get-go. Mm-hmm. Interacting with the public has kind of been a part of your process from the very beginning, especially mm-hmm. as you were getting into your larger tenure-track positions, especially after mm-hmm. you got your PhD.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've honestly always been committed to sort of open science, and open the sort of open science and digital humanities. I feel like that grew out of computer science in a way, you know, where you have a sort of open coding this sort of open access movement that started, I don't know, maybe in the 90s or something. I'm terrible at the history of computer science, but this sort of, you know, idea of open data, of being open about everything, has always informed what I do. And it just sort of naturally led to blogging and to trying different things in my own research. Sorry, can you hear my phone ringing in the background? Okay,
yeah. It's totally fine.
She's so busy. Very cool. That idea is really interesting too, in terms of like finding inspiration from seemingly not, you know, counterintuitive places like computer science. Because you're right, the idea of open access is really interesting. And I mean, I do design anthropology on my side, and a lot of like that sprung out of these notions. Like actually, the same thing that came from computer science, and also just people doing this like HCI, you know, human computer interaction research. Mm-hmm. And what's been funny about that to think, and I think you just inspired me to think about this too, is that we do see this kind of shifting of anthropology itself. Really in response to, you're right, to computer science, and that when it comes out that the kind of information produced through computer science tends to be open access, right? And that, you know, is anthropology following suit, or are social sciences in general following suit? They could be. I mean, we are seeing a lot, you know, big changes in terms of like some journals have open access, and they're the golden master mm-hmm. open access now and such like that. I wonder, and this is just a speculative question, but if we see things like journals like Elsevier or Taylor and Francis, if they were to magically become open access, which is unlikely, but if they were, you know, would that, and this is, you know, would the public's interaction with our kind of research, anthropological research, be different? And I'm thinking about this because obviously, as you said too, like we use different language for different audiences. And this is a totally speculative question, you know, but I mean, do you think, would we see kind of a shift in terms of how people would engage with anthropological research? Would we see more people reading American Ethnologist?
No, I don't think so. I kind of doubt it. Our writing, especially in journal articles, tends to be impenetrable. It's really hard to strike a balance between something that people will be interested in reading and something that sort of meets the standard that we've already set for, you know, sort of science and social science articles. And I try the best I can with my articles. I've definitely had some come back where people say, oh, this is really this is really readable. And I'm not sure it's a compliment. I take it as a compliment, but I'm not sure if it is.
Yeah.
I try my best. But no, I mean, you know, I think it is important to open access, but I think it's more important to have openly accessible data than it is to have openly accessible papers and interpretations, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, without the data, how am I supposed to check, you know, what other people are doing to essentially check their work? How am I supposed to use their data as, you know, contrast or a complementary data set to my own if it's not online anywhere? Mm-hmm. And so to me, data access is sort of the most important thing facing us right now.
How do you go about that issue of data access? Because, I mean, like you're saying, data is sort of the basis for which we make these sort of scientific endeavors with our work. We ask our questions, we build our hypotheses, we test them, and hopefully it all works out. Mm-hmm. But then sharing that, how do you go about sharing it?
For my part, I have shared my database from my dissertation project because I really wanted to do it from the get-go, like from the very beginning. But I felt, you know, I need to publish this. I need to publish my interpretations of these results. A lot of work, a lot of money went into this. So after I was sort of confident that I had, you know, spun out enough papers and gotten a tenure track job, then I put the entire database online. And so it's, I think, CCBY, you know, SA or something. Anybody can use it. They need to credit me if they want to do anything with the data. And there are some unpublished data in there. There are, you know, measurements or I think cranial non-metrics. There are a bunch of data that I just didn't work up into a publication, but I didn't feel like I should keep that to myself. You know, they're data that I collected and produced under NSF funding, and it's important to put that out there. So that's what I've done with that project, and you know, with my next project at Gabii, that will go up as soon as I can. And my forthcoming project this summer, I'm going to Aplantis, and you know, that will go up as soon as I can put it up as well. So I mean, it's an access relational database that anybody can access if they want.
Oh, that's fantastic. Cool. It sounds like you have several different projects that have been going on in pretty close proximity. How do you manage that?
How do I manage anything? I don't know. No, I mean, my dissertation project is done. I did that data collection. Gabii, which is just outside of Rome, I am in sort of the you know, analysis and publication stage there. They're not generating any new skeletons for me, but I'll be on site in just a couple weeks. And then I'm starting a new project. So, you know, it's that idea that you have publications coming out, and then you have publications in development, and then you have your new research project that you're working on so that you can keep the pipeline going and just keep doing more science.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I mean, we've talked a lot about so many subjects today. They're really great to get into. We only have about 5 minutes or so left at this point. So maybe you might want to share with us an origin story, if you will.
An origin story. So I like to say that if I were a superhero, then my origin story would start with X-rays. And that's because when I was 7 years old, I broke my arm. I was running, we were racing across the street, because of course we were playing in the street, you know, it was the 80s. we were racing across the street, and I tripped over the, you know, the kid that I was racing, and I fell, and I broke my wrist. My mom took me to the doctor, and he x-rayed it, and he asked me if I wanted to know how tall I would be when I grew up. Ooh. And it just blew my mind. As a seven-year-old, that this doctor could predict how tall I'd be just from my bones.
Right.
And it sort of stuck in the back of my mind as I started studying the ancient Romans and the Greeks. I started going through old textbooks. This is what I did for fun in middle school. I read classical archaeology textbooks.
Nice.
I was a giant nerd. And you know, I kept looking at these skeletons, like the grave circles at Mycenae, the Mask of Agamemnon, this famous gold mask, and there were these skeletons, and nowhere in the textbook was there anything about the skeletons and who, you know, what you could tell from the skeletons. So that's sort of my origin story. I wanted to look at the skeletons of first ancient Greeks and then ancient Romans. And, you know, because of the sort of experience I had as a kid, because, you know, my mom was a nurse, you know, I knew that the human body could tell you more things than I could find in these textbooks.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I like the idea of being the nerd and going through all these old textbooks, watching documentaries on TV. I think Adam and I were enchanted by anthropology in much the same way.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we both have an idea of Agamemnon's mask and watching these documentaries on Troy, right? It's totally capturing to a young person's imagination. Sure. So you also have a new paper coming out, and we thought that it might be great if you could tell us just a little bit about that.
Sure. I have a chapter in a book called Bioarchaeologists Speak Out, which is edited by Jane Bykstra. And Jane put together this fantastic AAA session last November, I guess, with all of us bioarchaeologists coming together to talk about the media and how essentially we can get on message about various topics. And so, you know, my chapter that's coming out talks about sort of the importance of reaching out to the general public, some of the values of science communication, things like public intellectualism, how we can support one another in order to, you know, make stuff like this count for tenure and promotion and, you know, help people when they're beset by trolls on the internet. But it also includes some, you know, sort of information on DIY outreach, you know, do it yourself. You know, here are some steps that you can take in order to do this. So I'm not sure when that's coming out, but that's my latest publication in the vein of public outreach.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is really in line with what we're going for with this series. And I think it's something that we can definitely recommend in the show notes, as well as in the post when that comes out with this episode, too. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Christina Kilgrove, thank you so much for speaking with us today. This has been an awesome conversation. We've learned a lot. We love to see that bioarchaeology and archaeology is blowing up in terms of really awesome ways of speaking to the public. And it's really encouraging and inspiring to see the work that you're up to.
And personally, I want to get back to the old world and look at some more excavations going on there. I've been in Latin America for a little too long. I think I need to start changing my scenery for a little bit.
There you go. We have a changed mind on our first during the recording. Amazing. We've done it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.